I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. There were protests last night in a number of cities in response to a Staten Island grand jury's decision not to prosecute police officer Daniel Pantaleo for the death of Eric Garner. Pantaleo had used a chokehold when arresting Garner for selling illegal cigarettes. Garner later died from, quote, compression of neck, compression of chest, and prone position during physical restraint by police. That's according to a medical examiner's report that ruled the death a homicide. The incident was caught on tape and raises a whole host of questions about police behavior. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder speaking on Wednesday night.
Now, we've all seen the video of Mr. Garner's arrest. His death, of course, was a tragedy. All lives must be valued. All lives. Mr. Garner's death is one of several recent incidents across our great country that have tested the sense of trust that must exist between law enforcement and the communities they are charged to serve and to protect. This is not a New York issue, nor a Ferguson issue alone. Those who have protested peacefully across our great country following the grand jury's decision in Ferguson have made that very clear.
This week's ruling comes on the heels of a grand jury decision not to indict police officer Darren Wilson for the shooting death of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And yesterday, the Justice Department released a damning report about the Cleveland Police Department's use of excessive force and deadly force. Today on Radio Times, we talk about what this all means for police and community relations, especially when residents are African American. We have two of our three guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studio. Dwayne Royster is Executive Director of POWER. That's a racial justice organization made up of 41 congregations in Philadelphia. He's also a founding pastor of Living Water United Church of Christ. And Dwayne Royster, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. It's been about 15 years.
Amen. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is J. Scott Thompson. He's chief of police for Camden County, New Jersey. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning, Marty. How?
I'm very well. And I'm assuming everyone, if they haven't looked at this videotape of what happened to Eric Garner, they should. But let me begin with you, Scott Thompson. When you look at that videotape, what do you see?
Well, when I view the videotape, it's disturbing on its surface, and it certainly warrants a more thorough investigation, which I believe is still ongoing right now. The federal government, I think the Attorney General has committed to coming in with a pretty comprehensive review from the Department of Justice. I don't have all the facts that were presented to the grand jury. I don't think anybody really does at this point in time. But as a police chief, just viewing that video in and of itself, it's disturbing. And anytime that there is a loss of life, it's absolutely tragic.
What do you see when you look at that video?
I am frustrated, angry, enraged. Really asking myself the questions: does selling Lucy cigarettes equal a death sentence? Much the same way that we asked the question of Mike Brown, does jaywalking equal a death sentence as well? The police officers involved in this case became both the arresting officers, the prosecuting attorneys, and the judges simultaneously, and I think that is an absolute tragedy. All those officers on that man are trying to bring him down because he was selling Lucy cigarettes. I think it's an absolute travesty.
Well, and even going back to you, Scott Thompson, and there's a question about whether this was a chokehold or not. My understanding in New York, you're not supposed to. In fact, it's illegal to use a chokehold. When you look at that videotape, and again, this is what, as the public that we have, does that look like a chokehold to you?
I can't say whether that's a chokehold or not. I know that our policy within our organization is one in which we identify as a vascular restraint. And a vascular restraint is probably synonymous with a chokehold. And by our policy is only authorized when deadly force would be authorized. It's not to make routine arrests. It's not your first option when you're confronted with force. It would be essentially the equivalent of pulling out your firearm and shooting it.
Well, and even picking up on what we're talking about, Dwayne, are in these two incidents, unarmed black men.
Absolutely. Unarmed big black men, let's be honest, right?
You think the big is important?
Well, I think it's important. As we were talking about a little earlier before the radio program came on, Harvard University did a study on implicit bias. And in this particular study, the study showed that most people, when they see a black man walking down the street, their subconscious responds to them the same way they see an angry barking dog. And so when we're looking
as a threat, you're
saying. Absolutely. So this is why we see people walk to the other side of the street. Mothers grab their children tighter when they see a black man walking down the street. And so a big black man becomes an absolute threat. Actually, most folk are not threats, but people perceive them as being threats. It was actually most interesting to watch Darren Wilson's interview on ABC when he was looking. He talked about the fact how big Mike Brown was. If you take a look at Darren Wilson, Darren Wilson's 6'2". He's a big guy himself. He's not small, but yet he tries to, you know, he was perpetrating like, you know, this guy was huge and everything. A 17-year-old kid, jaywalking, killed, problematic, big black man. You know, people feel like they respond in a different way.
Well, going back to you, Scott Thompson, which is if there is this bias, and I do believe that there is, that it's something that we all have to be aware of. Can you train police to be aware of that, to know about the kind of stereotyping that goes on if they see, to use Dwayne Royster's word, a big black man?
Well, I'm familiar with the study that that Dwayne is referencing, and an implicit bias is not just with police officers, but it's within society in general.
Yes.
Which in how we are best combating that within Camden is to enhance interactions, is to increase the dialogue. We have to establish trust. The more people speak to one another, the more interactions people have with each other, the greater the level of trust will become. One gets to know each other, and we get beyond what is on the surface, and we get more at what is the core of the individual. Therefore, from a policing perspective, what we do is part of our strategies and our tactics are walking beats, our foot patrols, are the mandates for officers to get out of their squad cars and engage and interact with people, and not just when the 911 call goes out. Because otherwise, you'll have a police force that's reduced to interacting with people during absolute times that are at their worst, both for the situation and the individuals themselves. And we need to have the interactions between the public, particularly the ones that need us the most, which are the communities, the minority communities, and the interactions with the people that are charged with protecting it.
I don't need to tell you, Dwayne, but I know a number of African-American men and also guests that have been on the show who everyone has an anecdote about being stopped by the by the police for driving, for walking, for sort of minor even incidents that have nothing to do with criminality.
Absolutely. I mean, I have.
But picking up on what our other guest was saying about figuring out how to mend this relationship. How do you suggest going forward?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. I certainly agree with the chief over here that there has to be an issue of interaction. But I also – there's actually training that has to be done to address the issue of implicit bias. People come into these particular jobs as servants, as police on the police force, and they have their biases with them. And if they are not intentionally attacked on a regular basis to really draw those biases out and begin a process of reframing how we operate in our subconscious, they are not going to be able to deal with the issue of bias. You know, on a daily basis, we are inundated with millions of things that come into our sensory perception, and we have to be able to process that in a very fast pace. These officers that are out on the street are responding in tense situations, and they're going to respond in a way that's going to protect them first, and then go after the other issues.
Do you agree with that?
I do, yes.
Does it matter to you, Dwayne, what race a police officer is, if we're talking about the racial relationship between police officers and the people that they are charged to protect or even arrest?
Yes and no. I think it does. There are we have officers that grow up in communities where they do not have positive interactions with people of color. I think it's much more difficult to deal with them. But the reality is that implicit bias also shows that it impacts people of color in the same way. So black folks still see black men as angry black dogs, I mean, angry dogs as well. But I think the issue becomes that sometimes we are able to process that differently because that could easily be us. But I think there's also a way that the police departments, because they deal with so many negative aspects of the community, begin at a certain point to just see everything in a negative light and not really process it in a way that says, maybe this is just a kid that's doing absolutely nothing wrong.
I wanted, go ahead. It looks like you want to say something.
And the pastor is absolutely correct, and that is why the strategy and the tactics of having officers interact with residents and children in the time when they're not being called for a critical incident is extremely invaluable. Look, there's as much of an education that the community can provide our police officers than we can do within the four walls of the building in which we train our people. And it's, addressing the issue of implicit bias is a huge mountain that as a police organization we need to overcome, but it's a much larger issue within society in and of itself. And even when we start that, and I've had conversations with TV executives from some of our various markets when, when it's constantly being messaged of the it's very consistent with what we saw with the Trayvon Martin issue too, right? Not every person of color with a hooded sweatshirt is committing criminal activity. And that's why it's important for the police officers who are charged with keeping that community safe. Because remember, at the same time, a lot of times this ends up happening in communities where there are the highest incidents of violent crime. And the community is telling us, we need you here to protect us. We want our streets to be safe. But it's important that the cops know who are the people within the community. Nobody minds when you're stopping the troublemakers time and time again. What people mind is when you treat everybody the same.
You see them all as troublemakers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
But I also want to say, too, I think it's really critical that, while we're talking about the police department, we also need to be talking about what's going on in the district attorney's office and, the grand juries. When we look at the situation with Darren Wilson, we look at the situation with Eric Garner. If we want to build trust, then we need to make sure that people who are doing these egregious behaviors, police officers doing this egregious attacks on members of the community, are also being held accountable by bringing to trial. And let them come to trial. Darren Wilson should be on trial right now. That officer up in New York City should be on trial right now. The officer that killed the gentleman that was in a toy store that was getting a toy gun for his kid in Cleveland that was killed, that was also not indicted yesterday, that they did not bring indictments in Cleveland, and the 12-year-old boy that was shot within 2 seconds of police arriving on the scene waving a toy gun, those officers should all be brought to trial. The fact that we're taking these to grand juries and not bringing them to trial is a problem. If they are innocent of what they are being accused of, then a trial will prove that out, not a grand jury. That's not the grand jury's responsibility.
I don't know if you want to go down that or not. We have about 30 seconds before our break, Scott Thompson.
Well, I think it gets back to what we're talking about, the larger issue. I mean, you got to remember that these grand juries are not comprised of police officers. They're comprised of people, the community. And it's consistent with what the pastor is saying as well, in that we have a much larger, broader issue here, that if this is not just the police, it's one of which it's a system. And right now, the police and law enforcement in general, we need to keep our ears and our minds open because we need to consent of the people to be able to be effective. And what the people are telling us is they want change. And so we have to look at what needs to be changed and find an effective way to do that.
And that's J. Scott Thompson. He is chief of police for Camden County, New Jersey. Also with us is Dwayne Royster. He's executive director of Power. Also a founding pastor of Living Water United Church of Christ. We are talking about these two grand jury decisions and what it says about police community relations. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. We are talking about the current state of police community relations in light of two grand jury decisions, a report released actually yesterday by the Justice Department about the Cleveland Police Department's use of excessive and deadly force. As I said earlier, Dwayne Royster and J. Scott Thompson have been talking about their reaction to the tape that was released about the arrest and then the subsequent death of Eric Garner in Staten Island. Joining us now is Solomon Jones. He's a regular columnist for Newsworks, also for the Philadelphia Daily News. He's the new host of Wake Up with WURD on 900 AM. And Solomon Jones, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Nice to be here.
And to our listeners, let me just make sure we get folks in on the conversation. Phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Solomon, let me just toss this to you, and I do want to get back to the conversation I've been having, but what is your takeaway from looking at the tape of the arrest and takedown of Eric Garner?
I thought it was very disturbing. I thought it was clear that something happened there that was worthy of investigation and, frankly, charges against that officer. And, you know, knowing what I know about the grand jury system, I know that prosecutors determine who the witnesses are. They determine what evidence is presented. And so in a large way, they determine what the outcome is going to be. And given that, you know, prosecutors and police have to work together in order to get the outcomes that they want when real crimes are committed, certainly I understand that relationship. But I think that something needs to happen other than grand jury type investigations when something this obviously wrong happens and someone loses their life as a result. And you know, beyond the tape, this officer already had some suits that had been filed in reference to his prior behavior with black men in particular. And so I kind of look at the police department not pulling him off the street, not giving him some retraining, not reassigning him to a place where he would not have the opportunity to do this as being partly responsible for what happened with Eric Garner.
You had mentioned, Duane, that he, Eric Garner, had been selling loose cigarettes on mm-hmm. the street. And there is this whole broken windows theory of policing, which is sure. You go after some of these petty crimes and that prevents larger issues. Do you see that as part of the problem here of going after some of the sort of nickel and dime type stuff rather than larger issues in communities?
I do believe it's problematic, and I think that there's a total racial bias to that. It was an interesting study the ACLU did that forced the Philadelphia Police Department to come up with statistics regarding their stops in the city of Philadelphia. And between 2006 and I think 2010 or 12, something like that, there was a 200% increase in the numbers of stops that were had. 80% of them were African Americans, mostly, you know, just being basically some stop and frisk policy, which really is not helpful in the community. It builds distrust. In addition to that, one of the interesting statistics that came out that pointed in Philadelphia that people in Philadelphia use, white and black folk use marijuana about the same percentage, but the majority of arrests in Philadelphia and prosecution for possession of marijuana and use of marijuana were like 65-70% African American. So when we have these kind of statistics going on, this is problematic. When we have specific targeting of communities of color, this is problematic. You know, at Power, we're looking at racial justice and economic justice issues and asking the hard questions about who's benefiting from the essentially the oppression of people of color in their own homes and in their own communities.
Who's benefiting from your perspective?
Well, I think that there are a lot of systems that are benefiting, you know, including police getting overtime, including the district attorney's office that are getting numbers up because people don't have sufficient resources to mount a proper defense. I think the prison industrial complex is benefiting from that as well. I mean, there are series of folk that are benefiting from the suppression and oppression of people mm-hmm. of color over petty issues.
Well, let me get you back in on the conversation, Scott Thompson. What do you say in response to what Duane Royster just said?
Well, I think that it's important to realize that, particularly in some of our more challenged neighborhoods, people's lives have been negatively defined by infractions that have that are quality of life issues. I can tell you that one of the challenges that we had in standing up a new organization in Camden, which has historically been an extremely violent city, was that people didn't feel comfortable enough to be able to come out of their own homes because folks operated with impunity. They drank in public. They urinated wherever they wanted. They drove around with their radios blaring. They rolled through stop signs, and they drove down the street at a speed in which children couldn't play on the street. So it was important for the quality of life of the people that lived in those neighborhoods for us to go and not just to walk around and try to catch the person that's doing the murder, because invariably us stopping major incidents from occurring or happen very, very few far between. It's the way of – so it's not so much the enforcement of smaller issues. It's how you do it. And it's important that you don't do it to the community but rather with the community. So when we go into a neighborhood and we're addressing these quality of life issues that to an outsider may seem minor, but it may mean a lot to the people that live on that block –
But including selling loose cigarettes, you think?
Well, I mean, you could take a variety of different types of complaints, whether it's drinking in public or, again, gambling on the corner. They're all minor infractions. They're not criminal offense. They're usually ones in which there's not a custodial arrest. It's an issuance of a summons and then moving on, and then they have their day in court. It's the manner. It's what comes down to what's called procedural justice. And what is more important to people is how the process occurs more so than the process in and of itself. And if you're treating people with respect and dignity, that seems to matter more to people than whether or not they get a ticket for the infraction that they committed.
You have a look on your face. Go ahead.
Yeah. I certainly hear that there were 8 police officers that brought Eric Garner down. 8 cops on top of him at the same time. For Lucy cigarettes? That's ridiculous. That's absolutely insane. I certainly hear, talking about the loud music. Was it Jordan Davis was killed in Florida because he was playing his music too loud when somebody shot him as a result of that? These things are not worth death sentences. Jaywalking does not equal death sentence. Selling Lucy cigarettes, playing your music too loud does not equal death sentences. And these are issues that we have to address. But in addition to that, the chief is saying, basically, that, these communities are in trouble. They're in community because there's been systematic disinvestment in communities of color across the country, whether it's in public education that power's fighting for right now, that we're showing $1,800 a student difference between majority white school district and majority black school districts, or whether we're operating with the low-wage plantation mentality that we have here in Philadelphia, where the majority of low-wage workers are people of color who are making money for folk that do not look like them.
Are police part of what you just described there? Are they sort of left to deal with?
They are the enforcement branch of the systemic oppression.
Go ahead, and then I want to get you back in, Solomon.
I think it's important also to remember that there are tens of thousands of interactions that happen between police and public every day. There are thousands of arrests that occur each and every day. And the vast, vast, vast majority are done by very good people that are dedicated to putting their lives on the line and are doing so in a manner that is consistent with the Constitution and the law. It's a system that's made up of human beings, and I'm not by any way, stretch of the imagination trying to provide justification for the instances that were mentioned by the pastor, because I agree they're disturbing, and they certainly warrant a deeper look by the highest level of government we have, and that's the Department of Justice. And I don't think there's a greater entity that has more expertise or resources to be able to ascertain all the facts, particularly the material ones.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's J. Scott Thompson. He is chief of police for Camden County, New Jersey. Dwayne Royster, executive director of Power, founding pastor of Living Water United Church of Christ. Solomon Jones, also with us as well, host of Wake Up with WURD at 900 a.m. He's also a blogger for Newsworks and a columnist for the Philadelphia Daily News. I want to play Esau Garner. This is the widow of Eric Garner at a press conference on December 3rd earlier this week, addressing the police officer Daniel Pantaleo's apology. Let's listen to this, and then Solomon will get a response from you.
The time for remorse would have been when my husband was yelling to breathe. That would have been the time for him to show some type of remorse or some type of care for another human being's life. When he was screaming 11 times that he can't breathe. So there's nothing that him or his prayers or anything else would make me feel any different. No, I don't accept his apology. No, I could care less about his condolences. No, I could care less. He's still working. He's still getting a paycheck. He's still feeding his kids. And my husband is 6 feet under. And I'm looking for a way to feed my kids now.
And again, Esau Garner, widow of Eric Garner. Your thoughts, Solomon?
Well, I think that, again, it goes back to a mentality that has a knee-jerk reaction when a police officer does something that is, in my view, illegal. In my view, what happened there was illegal. He took a life. He did it in spite of the fact he had 11 chances to let that man go.
Because
he said,
I can't breathe
11 times. And so, he did not do that. And the reason that he was out on the street, again, is because the police department kept putting him back out on the street after there were complaints against him. He stripped men naked on a street corner in Staten Island. There was a court case filed about that. He did a false arrest of another black man in Staten Island. There was a case about that. Black men are 21 times more likely to be killed by police. Young black men are 21 times more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts. There is certainly a race problem going on. As far as, you know, the petty crime thing in New York, you know, the loose cigarette thing is I agree, part of a systemic problem. When you're trying to use cigarettes in order to pay for what is going on in a municipality, when you have a $4.35 cigarette tax in New York, is what they had at that time, then you ask the police to enforce that. Well, you know, it's silliness, and it's silly to, you know, take a man and violently arrest him, throw him to the ground, smash his face into the sidewalk, resulting in his death over a $4.35 cigarette tax. And so there is a systemic problem. There is something that we need to look at. And I don't blame her for not accepting his apology, mm-hmm. because his behavior in the past has shown that he views black men in a way that they can be humiliated, that they can be abused, and that his badge gives him the right to do so. And then to have the New York version of the FOP then back him up without all the facts and say, this guy's right because he's a police officer, I think that that is wrong. And so there has to be some kind of independent, community-based voice that allows us to have some input into what happens with these officers who are abusing people in our community.
And I don't want to get lost on this, but I know some of the storekeepers were complaining because they sell cigarettes as well, that here was someone who was selling them, you know, and not having to pay the tax.
He shouldn't have to pay the death penalty either. And that death penalty was instituted, you know, by a police officer on the street. And again, I don't have anything against all police officers. I have neighbors who are police officers. There are police officers who are doing great work. But in my view, when good men stand by and do nothing, evil prevails. And so the good police officers have a responsibility, both legally and socially, to stop these guys from doing this.
Well, let me turn to you, Scott Thompson. And one of the solutions that's been talked about, then we'll get to our callers, is bring in cameras, have cops basically wearing cameras, have cameras in cars. I mean, we saw what happened in New York because it was caught on camera. Is that a solution? So that we all get to see more of what happens on the street?
Well, I am a proponent of cameras. We're currently piloting cameras now. I think that it can it certainly helps with transparency. It certainly helps with recounting what has occurred, particularly during critical incidents. I think that the use of the cameras is the future of policing. I don't think there's any way around it. I think that I know the more progressive police leaders that support that, as do the public. But it's not a panacea, as you saw, that those officers could have had on cameras in New York. And I agree with Solomon. And I also would, in line with what Solomon said, I agree with from a law enforcement perspective. Look, we have to understand that the people have died in this, and that's extremely tragic. And when loved ones are talking, emotions are going to run very high, and rightfully so. And now is not the time for us, when things are said, for law enforcement to take a circle the wagons mentality and start to counterpunch on issues. I don't think that that's an appropriate response, because at the end of the day, the police are the people and the people are the police. We need the consent of the people to be able to effectively do our jobs. And you know, you don't see all police doing that across the board, but some that are doing it, I would caution them against that type of tactic.
We could go back and forth here on this, but I do have a lot of people that want to join our conversation, including looks like Dan from West Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Dan. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
You actually just touched on basically what I wanted to ask. I've heard recently a lot of excuses regarding this event with Mr. Garner, that this wasn't there was no criminality with, when they witnessed the videotape, and so it was just incompetence. And I don't understand how that's mm-hmm. an excuse, that incompetence is a pardon. A doctor couldn't say, "Oh, I was supposed to do a heart surgery, but I removed his kidney and he died, and so I was incompetent, but I didn't mean to do it. It wasn't a criminal act, so I'm scot-free." And just the idea that I don't understand why these big organizations, like police departments or the Catholic Church, when there are people who are clearly doing things that are wrong, there's this mentality where you rally around people regardless of the stupidity or incompetence involved. Why is there not this more of a rally around the good cops saying, no, we don't want to be in light with these guys. We want to be perceived as competent and good, which I'm sure most of them are. But I never hear a police officer, a fellow police officer, say, no, this guy's an idiot and he should be brought to trial.
Okay,
that would, I think, would go a long way towards making people feel like we can trust the police because they're not just this rote mindset.
Okay.
Lockstep.
No, I hear you, Dan. Let me give Dwayne Royster a chance to respond.
I think you're 100% right. I think that if other officers would apply the same social pressure to other police officers, basically saying, look, well, no, I'm not going to back you up on this, I think it would go a long way. I think they're afraid to do that because many of them are fearful of their lives every day when they go to work. And if they put pressure on somebody else, they might not back them up when the time comes.
The Ethical Society of Police, which represents black police officers in St. Louis, after the St. Louis players did the hands up, don't shoot gesture, and they were castigated by the St. Louis version of the Fraternal Order of Police. Well, the Ethical Society of Police, which represents African-American officers there, did exactly what the caller is talking about. They stood up and said that they supported the Rams, calling their actions commendable. And then they did a statement which said that the St. Louis Police Officers Association statement against those players does not represent the opinion of a majority of African-American officers. And so there are officers and there are organizations across the country in some cases that are standing up and saying, wait a minute, you know, this is wrong. And you can't have a knee-jerk reaction. How can you defend something before an investigation has taken place and say, oh, that person was right? You don't know whether or not they were right.
Hold on. I hate the clock sometimes because it means I do have to take a break. But and I know all three of you want to respond to what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. We are talking about a recent grand jury decision earlier this week in Staten Island or on Staten Island not to prosecute a police officer for what looked like the choking death of a man named Eric Garner. This comes on the heels of a grand jury decision in Ferguson, Missouri. And again, our guests are Dwayne Royster, J. Scott Thompson, and Solomon Jones. Much more after the short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen talking with Solomon Jones, J. Scott Thompson, and Dwayne Royster, a bunch of callers, and I'm seeing lots of tweets and emails as well. It looks like you wanted to say something back to Solomon right before the break.
And I think that it's important to also keep in mind, again, let me preface what I'm about to say with the vast majority of people in law enforcement are there to do the right things and are doing the right thing day in and day out. And the issues with that the pastor had talked about where officers intervening on other officers happens far more times than the public ever knows about. In fact, when most of the time when officers are prosecuted for corruption or things of that issue, it's generally their fellow officers that have brought it forward. They're just not calling a press conference and letting everybody know about it. But the system that we have for both identifying the those that don't belong in this line of work and the system of how we provide justice when critical incidents occur is clearly needs a lot of work to it.
So, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's really interesting to say that, though. A retired Philadelphia police captain went down to Ferguson in support of the protesters down there and really called out racism within police departments across the country, but in also talking about the city of Philadelphia. Commissioner Ramsey's response was, we have to make sure he maintains the integrity of the uniform. And the FOP president here in Philadelphia said he ought to be arrested. If that's how, you know, police are helping, you know, support other police, I'm not sure that we're really doing a good job.
Just to be fair on that issue, that has more to do with a retired individual that's still donning a uniform and acting as though they're an active officer more so than the content of what they're saying or what they're doing.
Let me get Jamie from, looks like Baltimore, to join us. Jamie, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you, and hello to everyone there.
Hi there.
I just wanted to make two really quick points. I wanted to say that that one, we need to stop the relationship, or do something different about prosecutors, you know, acting almost as like defense attorney you know, for the officers in these kinds of cases. That's what it looks like to everyone watching. You know, the prosecutors, they can turn, you know, they can turn things either way that they want the jurors to see things. And so I think that, you know, in all fairness, that needs to be stopped. And then also I want to say that I've had, I'm a 35-year-old black man, you know, but I've had good encounters, you know, with officers as well. And I think that it all starts at the initial meeting of the officer and whoever he's, you know, questioning or whatever. I think that as, you know, I'm a CDL holder, so it's always in my best interest, you know, to be polite and, you know, and be respectful of whatever officer I encounter. And normally, you know, I receive the same back from him, you know. And so I think on all sides we can all do better, you know. I also think that...
Well, you know what, Jamie, let me take your point because you made a good one, and we got a lot of callers, and I want to give someone a chance, maybe to you, Solomon. He's saying, look, what happens at that first encounter is extremely important, and that both sides need to have respect for each other.
It is important, but I do think that we have to bear in mind, again, and I can't you know, emphasize this enough, that young black men are 21 times more likely to be shot by a police officer than their white counterparts. That is not a coincidence. That is not, you know, oh, well, they, you know, just because the black men were doing something more wrong than the white men. You know, there is a hashtag going around now on Twitter. I encourage you to check it out, called Criming While White.
Yeah.
And where you have people kind of acknowledging their privilege, acknowledging that, yes, I got stopped for DUI and the cop let me go. Yes, I was shoplifting and the cop let me go. Yes, when I was 14, I committed a crime, and because my family came down and they thought we looked like nice people, they let me go. I mean, there is a phenomenon, and you know, I hate to, you know, let people know this, but there's a phenomenon called white privilege. And so, you know, when black people are talking about these things, it's not that we are racist for calling out racism. It is that we are trying to bring a real problem to bear. And unless we have, and I agree with the commissioner, unless we have those relationships where we can have these honest conversations, then nothing is going to change. And it starts with relationship. And so when police go in and they are policing communities, it has to start first with relationship. And from that, you get respect.
But I,
very,
you know,
quickly, because I want to play a clip from Mayor Bill de Blasio.
Yeah,
go
just
ahead.
Real quick, I want to say, you know, but it's not, it can't always be about relationship. I remember some years ago, my brother's here with me today. I was on my way to a revival, driving up City Avenue with a couple of my friends who were going to be performing at this particular revival. As we're driving up City Avenue, we're right where TGIF Fridays is right now, and a cop, and I'm going, so I'm on the suburban side of City Avenue. And I turned to my brother and said, we're going to get pulled over. And the cop followed us for 3 miles all the way up to toward 63rd Street. And they finally pulled us over. Three police cars. They jump out of their cars, guns drawn on us. Yeah. I am wearing a clerical collar in the car. They accuse us of stealing the car that we're in. They make us stick our hands out of the window, and they make us sit there for 15 minutes. When they come back to the car, they have taken off their name badges. They have taken off their nameplates. And they said, sorry for bothering you. We were mistaken. When I called later on that night to the police precinct to file a complaint, they told me they had no record of a stop being done on City Avenue that day.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, what, Scott Thompson, what do you do about that?
Well, what we do about it, I mean, we have technologies that prevent that from occurring. I mean, I have GPS devices in all of my police cars' vehicles, all my officers' vehicles.
Do you know where they are, what they're doing?
All the pastor would have to say is where he was and when it was, and we'd be able to ascertain exactly who was there and what they did. And I also think that that's where part of the technology with body cameras can help eliminate some of those issues.
Yeah, that's the question I asked Commissioner Ramsey when I interviewed him just a couple of days ago. I said, what good is it to have cameras? If you have a camera, it shows the incident. It shows this man being killed by police for selling loose cigarettes, and we still don't get an indictment. And that's why I think that there has to be a larger discussion around the criminal justice system as a whole. And you can't allow the prosecutor to use a grand jury to get the decision that he wants. No, if charges are warranted, you have to bring charges so that there is an adversarial system in which you decide who's guilty or innocent.
Let me get Carol from, looks like Lumberton, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Carol, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Folks seem to be talking around another issue, and that is, why does it seem necessary to shoot to kill? Mm-hmm. If an officer feels threatened, there's something else he can do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I hate to say it, but he could shoot him in the knee. Why is it apparently taught to shoot to kill. And that little boy with the toy gun was shot 6 times in the chest. Come on. What? Well, anyway, I'll take my answer.
No, Carol. We're all just taking in what you said because, yeah. And I guess I should go back to you, Scott Thompson, on that. I mean, from some of these incidents, it does certainly raise the question that Carol just raised.
Well, the key to it from a policing perspective is the training up until the point of trying to exercise every possible option we have prior to pulling the gun and pulling the trigger. It's to not to thrust yourself into situations. Don't have the police create the agency. If somebody has a gun, keep distance, keep space, keep cover between you and that individual. I'm talking about the Cleveland incident. I don't know why you would pull directly up on an individual you thought had a gun.
And apparently, it happened very quickly.
Yes, it's the training on how to approach these situations. It's the arming the officers of every possible option, from pepper spray to tasers to giving them the ability to use things other than their sidearm. But to answer Carol's question, when we do have to deploy our sidearm and we do have to fire it, the training is to stop the threat and to shoot at center mass. And that is
center mass meaning
center mass of the
body.
Right, of the body, and that is so that the bullet doesn't go down range and hit anyone else. But it's also because you have now identified if you are pulling that threat, it's because your life or someone else's life is in danger.
When Solomon says that if you're a black man, you're many more times likely to be shot by a police officer, what do you say in response to that?
Well, it's part of this is what we face in society as a whole, right? Is that a lot of this is not just also – I mean, you can't ignore the fact that race is involved, but a lot of this is also along social stratification and issues of poverty, which is a much larger context than what we're talking about here today. But it's not by happenstance that the poorest communities are generally minority communities, and they're also the ones that require the greatest amount of police presence and interaction. It's also where the greatest amounts of violent crime are generally concentrated into, and then police are into that environment. And it's often with ambiguous circumstances that are rapidly unfolding. And so the best way that we can address that is to create an organization with a culture in which you don't fear people based upon their look, based upon the initial appearance. It's develop a relationship and get to know people beyond just the critical incident. That's the best way to begin addressing the
issue. Hold on one. I just want to play. This is New York Mayor Bill de Blasio at a press conference earlier this week following the announcement that there would be no indictment of Daniel Pantaleo in the death of Eric Garner. Let's listen, and then, Dwayne, I'll give you a chance to respond.
This is now a national moment of grief, a national moment of pain and searching for a solution. And you've heard in so many places people of all backgrounds utter the same basic phrase. They've said Black Lives Matter. And they said it because it had to be said. It's a phrase that should never have to be said. It should be self-evident. But our history, sadly, requires us to say that Black Lives Matter. Because, as I said the other day, we're not just dealing with a problem in 2014. We're not dealing with years of racism leading up to it, or decades of racism. We are dealing with centuries of racism that have brought us to this day. That is how profound the crisis is.
Dwayne, your thoughts?
Yeah, so the thing that's a good speech by Mayor de Blasio, actually an interesting piece of that speech that you didn't play was that he talked about the fact that he and his wife had to have a sit-down and have a conversation with their son, who is African-American. Mayor de Blasio's wife is African-American. And he had to acknowledge that his own son is not safe with the police department that he's responsible for. I think that that's a travesty and a tragedy in a very big way. I want to go back to something that you talked about earlier.
Sure.
I really believe that we need to have independent prosecutors that are assigned to every egregious police shooting that's independent of the DA's office, that has their own force and authority to investigate these issues that can be addressed. I also want to go back to something that the chief said and something that I mentioned earlier. There has been systemic disinvestment in communities of color across this country. in Pennsylvania, one of three states that doesn't have a full funding formula for schools, Power has been working diligently to point out that majority white school districts get more funding than majority minority school districts, almost to $1,800 per student per year. We have a preponderance of low-wage workers, so we disinvest in the schools. We don't train folk to be able to do jobs outside of low-wage work. We give them low-wage work. And then we ask the question why they are selling Lucy's to be able to try to survive, or they're joining other underground economy to be able to try to make it one way or the other. It's a total system failure that has to be addressed all the way across.
Let me get Mike to join us. Mike from Phoenixville. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi.
Profiling was mentioned earlier. I was the target of what I will describe, for lack of a better term, as reverse racial profiling. I'm born and raised in Philly. I now live in the suburbs. I was driving across the city from Fishtown to Germantown, so I went straight across Lehigh or Allegheny. A patrol car got behind me. I assume he ran the tags. After several blocks, I was stopped. I was taken out of the car, pockets emptied, patted down. I was put in the back of the patrol car while my vehicle was searched with my permission, because I had nothing to hide. That officer overreacted. Proper training would have informed his discretion that since I did not appear uneasy, I had nothing to hide. Nonetheless, his initial assumption that a white guy from the suburbs driving through the heart of North Philly at night was likely buying drugs, that initial assumption was not completely off base. Profiling, when properly implemented with good training, supervision and accountability, is good policing. Good training will prevent the overreaction that your panelists suffered on City Avenue and that I suffered.
Well, Mike, let me take your points and let me toss it to you, Solomon Jones.
Yeah, I'm real skeptical of that. I mean, you know, you can make up all the excuses that you want. I don't want to be racially profiled. If I'm doing something wrong, then stop me. Right. If you have suspicion that I am doing something wrong based on my individual behavior, not on how I look, then stop me. But if I'm not, then leave me alone. You know, that is my right as an American citizen. And believe it or not, I am an American citizen. And we pay our taxes in order to have a police department, in order to have a prosecutor's office, in order to have all of these things. In reference to the crime in the black community and the poverty in the black community, certainly there is poverty in the black community. There is a 26% overall poverty rate in Philadelphia. 31% of people in the black community are in poverty, which means that 69% of black people in Philadelphia are not impoverished. And so, you know, to have us, those of us who are not impoverished, those and even people in impoverished communities, they go to work every day.
That's right.
For the most part. Right. These are people who are working low wage jobs in order to make ends meet in their family. The statistics say that there were about 1,100 black people shot last year. Right. Let's assume that all of them were shot by other black people, because after all, people commit crimes against people who are close to them, who look like them, etc. Let's assume that all of them were shot by other black people. Guess what? It's 680,000 black people in the city of Philadelphia, which means the vast majority of us, 99% of us, are not involved in that behavior, and we should not be jeopardized because there are those who are.
I'm giving you the last word, Dwayne Royster. We have about 20 seconds, and I regret I'm saying that.
I really appreciate that. I think we again, I go back, we have systems failure here. We have to address it. It's not just the police. It's the DA's office. It's the judicial system in itself. We have a lot of work we have to do. We have to address racial injustice in this country.
Can we do that, Scott?
Along the line with everything that was said here, if you see something, say something. Police misconduct, if you're being mistreated, report it. Let us know about it. That's the only way we can fix it.
Well, I wish we could go on because we just scratched the surface here, but I appreciate the fact that all three of you joined us today in Radio Times. J. Scott Thompson, Chief of Police for Camden County, New Jersey, thanks for coming in. Dwayne Royster, Executive Director of Power, also founding pastor of Living Water United Church of Christ, thank you for coming in. And Solomon Jones, he's a blogger for Newsworks here at WHYY, also the new host of Wake Up with WURD on 900 AM. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program and hopefully carry on the conversation that I saw on both screens here in our Philadelphia studio. I'm Marty Moscowain. Stay with us for hour two. We'll be right back.